I am Harriet Tramer, and I hope you will join me when I host Reaching for the Gold on BBS Radio. We'll discuss aging and how you, as well as those you love, can navigate your way through your maturing process and even make it an adventure. This show will be broadcast on Tuesday afternoons every other week right at this time. It should be a chance to learn and also to be entertained. Reverend Ken Dugan was instrumental in developing the Med Cottage. These structures are tiny enough to be installed virtually anywhere, but despite their small size, they can serve as an alternative to nursing home care because they are specifically equipped to ensure the safety and medical well-being of elderly residents, even those who are medically fragile. Dr. Dugan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Harriet. And I'm always pleased to be able to talk about my favorite subject, and it's just nice to be on the air with you.
Thank you. How did you get involved with Med Cottages? Was this through your involvement with your church, Salem Wesleyan Church, or through N2Care? Tell us a little bit about how this happened.
Well, how it happened, about 8 years ago, I decided to return to college and to get a PhD in something other than religious studies. And so as I began to research, I noticed how the rest of the world took care of aging people and how that was so much different than we did in America. And one of the things I concluded was, we did it the way that we do it because we didn't have a lot of options. And so we set out to create additional options to what were already out there for people particularly that wanted to be involved in what we call family managed care.
Okay, you say how the rest of the world handled aging issues and aging care. How do they? Give us an example of how that works.
Well, it ranges all the way from the Japanese, where as you age, you almost reach a god status, to South America and places like Europe, where aging loved ones come back into the home of one of the children. Most often, it's the eldest daughter, and the aging family member comes back into their home. And oftentimes, the rest of the family supports that daughter in the upkeep and taking care of her. But other than maybe the UK and maybe Canada, virtually no other country in the world has things like nursing homes or assisted living or that kind of thing. Now, some countries have what are called granny flats, and that was some of the inspiration for what we eventually created.
Okay, but one thing. I understand what you said about our handling, Americans handling aging care issues differently than does the rest of the world. But can the way we handle aging care issues be looked at separately from other aspects of our country? In other words, you're talking about South America. You're talking about Japan and what they do, and that's wonderful. But they're South America and they're Japan, and they do everything differently than us because they're different countries. Why would you expect us to handle aging care in the same manner they do when we don't handle anything else in the same manner they do?
One of the things that I found in my research is as we age, one of the greatest fears that we have is being isolated. And if for no other reason, that would be justification enough. In other words, as we age, instead of wanting more distance, we want less distance. And we almost become tribal in our feelings about family and wanting to be there, wanting to be a part of that. And emotionally, it becomes the focus of our life as other things become less important, like our jobs and our houses and cars and those kind of things. And so we wanted a tool that enabled people to have this option if they chose this option. And before, even if they wanted to, other than moving somebody in or adding a room on, it was not easy. And so we want to make that as easy. And in the end, it is far less expensive than nursing homes or assisted living because you purchase it and it's a one-time fee. And then when you're finished with it, you can sell it back or do whatever you want with it. So there was more than just one consideration, but it was international travel that spurred my interest, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. I know you did study in Japan. Now, when you talk about aging people wanting to come together, wanting to have a community, I know that you have a religious background, that you're a reverend. Would you look at this as a spiritual matter, not just a emotional need, but a spiritual growth or change?
Well, I definitely feel that in my faith that we have a responsibility to our parents. And I feel like that not only do we have that responsibility, but it is almost, I see that as a privilege, not as a responsibility. But that's something that you have to teach, and it's something that you also have to, at some level, feel a spiritual responsibility to, or often it just seems like too much of an interruption to this culture. But
mm-hmm.
there is definitely a spiritual aspect in it for me. Now, we don't sell that or promote that or guilt people into that, but for me personally, yes, it's very much a part of my faith.
Now, when you say a spiritual aspect, you're saying a spiritual aspect for you. What I'm asking is maybe a little bit different. If I'm, which I'm not, 85 years old, is there a spiritual aspect to my wanting more togetherness than I ever did? My wanting to be with people more?
Yeah.
Is this a spiritual aspect?
I would not identify that necessarily as spiritual because I have friends that are not spiritual, and I see that in them as well. In other words, it's just something about as we age, we sort of yearn to be with our family, our children, our grandchildren, as other priorities begin to sort of wane in our life. For me, these things have been replaced by just almost a fraternal instinct. I don't know how else to describe it. And I see that in a lot of people, not just casually, but in our research, it was something that came through very clearly that we desire that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a big motivation.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you happen to get involved in aging issues?
Probably as much as anything, as a minister, every week I'm in nursing home facilities, assisted living facilities, and I never really saw anybody that wanted to be there if they had another option.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just began to ask myself, why is this that we feel this way? And I'm sure there is a need. In other words, I'm not saying there's not a need for nursing homes. There always will be. But just as kind of an inevitable place, it just seemed that it was overused for probably half to two-thirds of all the people that I visit and that I continue to visit.
Mm-hmm. But one thing, what's coming into my mind as we talk very clearly is how interrelated many things are. It's almost hard to say this, but I see financial considerations as being very interrelated with all of this. If I need care, and maybe my family's willing to give me the care I need, but they have to work. Unless I can pay somebody to care for me while my family is working, I may not have that much choice but a nursing home. These things can be financial.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, I'm in a federation. I work with those same people. I'm visiting their parents every week or every other week. And I understand that. What we felt like was that there was a transition period that could be as much as 3 to 5 years, that often people did not have, they really don't need to be there. It's just that there was basically no alternative to letting them be by themselves. In other words, many of us, and I'm not old, but I will be, there'll probably come a time that I need not to be by myself, but I'm not at a place where I need constant skilled care. And if we could extend people's independence by 2 years or 3 years at this stage in life, that's huge and very meaningful. We feel like also that this is financially a solution that permits people an option apart from consuming all their accumulated wealth in a place they'd rather not be. And,
how is it financially a solution? I'm not quite understanding that.
You can purchase a med cottage for the least expensive one is about $40,000, with the most expensive one being $75,000. But that's a one-time fee. In other words, just like purchasing a house or a car, then you don't make monthly installments on it. It's yours.
Mm-hmm.
Where a nursing home, in the course of 1 year, you would have paid for a med cottage, and in 2 years, you would have paid for possibly three med cottages.
Mm-hmm.
But it's defined. And at the end of it, end of the need, you can resell it. They're designed for seven placements, are what they're designed for. And
mm-hmm.
and so in that definition, you know exactly what you have. And,
could you buy a used one?
Eventually, yes. All of them that are either placed or in process are, the oldest one out there is like a year old, 12 months. And so they're very much yet in their prime period of use.
Mm-hmm.
And but I would say in 3 or 4 years, I'm sure that you could purchase a used one. And we intend to help facilitate that, our company does, so that people are able to have a marketplace for them as a used product.
Now, give me an example. You were saying an intermediate period, which could be a few years. Give me an example of how a med cottage could help extend somebody's independence. Give me maybe an example of somebody who has, in fact, used it in that way.
For instance, there's something about the second fall that is crucial. And almost a transition, an automatic transition to needing not necessarily skilled care, but constant supervision.
Mm-hmm.
But often that person, once they've gone through rehab, they may not be like they were before, but they're perfectly capable of orchestrating and maintaining their life and their independence. But maybe their children are afraid for them to be by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this would be an example of a great interim period there where the children are comfortable with them being by themselves, and they're surely not ready for what we call skilled care. And the med cottage, of course, has a system in it that monitors the floor. If someone falls, the family can pull that up on their either their iPhone or their computer, and they can see the floor. And they can monitor whether or not they've taken their medication. And so it allows independence without constant supervision.
Okay. If somebody is there and they fall, the family or a caretaker is automatically notified? How does that work?
There are two systems. One is there is motion sensors. And let's say that the med cottage, it's 9 o'clock and there's been no motion in there.
Mm-hmm.
That could generate a call. Or there's what we call feet sweep, which is a camera system that literally monitors about 12 inches off the floor. Now, the caregiver would have to pull that up every so often and look at it. But you can only see about maybe 12 or 16 inches off the floor. And so it preserves some level of privacy while permitting the caregiver to see whether or not someone was lying on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is a floor system, which is made by Boeing, which has a 38% force reduction, which if you did fall, it's less likely that the fall itself would do any more damage.
Oh, wait a minute. You're talking about something very relevant there. You're bringing up an important point, because my immediate question is, if somebody falls and is on the floor, whether you know immediately or not, sure, it's good you know immediately, but they may still be injured, and that's what you want to avoid. Can you explain a little about the technology you just mentioned?
The flooring system is made by a subsidiary of Boeing, which is called Satech. And this flooring system is about 6 years old. And you can drop an egg, and I've done this at trade shows many times, from probably 36 inches and let it land on the floor, and the egg doesn't break.
36 inches and it doesn't break?
No. And because we do this all the time, we put it in a plastic bag, and we let it drop, and it doesn't break. And at the same time, the floor is not soft or spongy like foam would be. But it's a technology that was made by Boeing Airlines, and so we used it in this application, which reduces the force of a fall by 38%, and which is considerable. I mean, it is a point at which it can be the point at which a bone is not broken.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a feature that you can have in a med cottage if those are issues that are primary. It also has a track system so that a caregiver can keep them mobile. If they're not mobile, you can get them out of the bed and take them to the shower or the toilet. And there's a track system all through the med cottage that permits them to do that.
Mm-hmm. In real life, have you had instances where somebody did fall and they might have broken a bone and they didn't because of this floor? In other words, it's one thing to throw an egg or do this or do that.
Yeah. I cannot tell you that I have an example. However, we do have a lady that as of April this year, she has lived in one for 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure in the course of 12 months that she's probably fallen. And I can't say that fall otherwise would have been a break fall, but I can tell you that she hasn't broken anything in the 12 months that she's been in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, who designed this med cottage? I mean, it sounds like you have a great deal of technical know-how that went into designing this.
We designed it really in conjunction with Virginia Tech, which is, of course, a university here in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our founders was an engineering professor there, and She's been on our staff since the very beginning, and the School of Urban Design really laid out the inside of it so that the space is all maximized, and every inch of it is used, and the School of Urban Design did that, and so we had a lot of help, and then we had an architectural firm that focuses on nothing but designing what we would think of as skill care facilities. And so there was a whole team of us that basically put this together.
Mm-hmm. And how big is it? What exactly does it contain? There's a bathroom, a kitchen. What exactly is there?
We now have two models, one that is 300 square feet and one that is 600 square feet that is made for two people. And because from our phone center, we realized that there were a lot of husband and wife teams that still wanted to be together. And so we've designed. And the one that's 600 square feet is much like an apartment in that it has a washer and a dryer and a kitchen. The one that's 300 square feet is designed very much like a private assisted living room. And it does have a kitchen. It does not have a stove, but it does have a kitchen.
Mm-hmm. And is there technology to make certain this person is taking their medication and things of that nature?
We have a what we call a med dispensing system in the med cottage. And even though it can't force you to take your medication, it can tell us if you don't. And and it gives you alarms, it talks to you and tells you it's time. The same way with blood pressure, same way with glucose, blood gases, all of those things, we have technology and that can be monitored either by your physician or by your family. And it's all HIPAA compliant and FDA compliant. So that it's the same quality as what you would have in a hospital or in a nursing home that was first class.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the legal issues? I mean, I wouldn't imagine in most communities, you can just say, oh, well, we're putting this granny pod right next to our house. Isn't this wonderful? Aren't there zoning issues which make this difficult, or is that less of a problem than you might suspect?
Well, it more and more is less of a problem. We were able to get a law passed in Virginia 2 years ago with the General Assembly here that exempted the med cottage with certain boundaries from all zoning ordinances in the state of Virginia.
Wow.
And
you got this through the legislature?
Yes. And, of course, we would love to do that in all 50 states. But surprisingly enough, and we have a national zoning consultant that did the consultant to several national chains. And what we have discovered, almost every municipality in the United States has a provision for what's called ADUs, auxiliary dwellings.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, it's not as easy as Virginia, but it's very doable. What is different is how long it would take you. In most other states, I think you're maybe in the Atlanta area. In Atlanta, it would take about probably 4 months to get through the zoning and the permitting process, but there is a provision there that would permit this. And San Francisco, we probably get the most calls from that area of any other part of the United States, and they too have a provision for what's called ADUs. And what's different is that in Virginia, it's automatic, and in most municipalities, it's a process that you have to go through, but there is a provision there for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the emotional or psychological? We can't assume that this aging relative particularly wants the situation. They may say, I want to be in my home. That's it. I don't want to live in this 300-square-foot place. I've got a nice big home here. What are you talking about? Is there a problem of acceptance?
Yes, and I just candidly, the acceptance is not the dwelling. The acceptance is in leaving their home.
Ah.
And that's a different thing. But we all want to stay as long as we can in control of our lives, even to the point of risking our own safety.
Mm-hmm.
We just do. And the lady that lives in the one in Fairfax, Virginia, did a piece with Voice of America, and her daughter talks about how resistant she was in the beginning, and now she loves it. It's her house, it's her room, and it's her television, and the grandkids run in and out of it, but I'm sure that was a process. I'm sure that wasn't that way the first month. It was something that eventually she embraced and now loves it. And I assume that most people would make that adjustment.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're kind of going to both poles here. We're talking about a nursing home. We're talking about totally independent living. In this day and age, there are so many different stages in between assisted living, very assisted living. There's NORCs, where older people live in a community and have many, many social services. There's a building near where I live, Musicians Towers, where people have their own independent apartment and they have many social services. There are just so many different variations between living independently in your own home and a nursing home. Do you still think there is this great need for the med cottages when there are so many other alternatives?
What we feel is that there is a need for our families to participate in our care at this stage in our life. And so everything that we do comes out of the notion of family participating in our care at this stage in our life.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't see this as the only solution. We're just about, most of all, promoting family involvement, and we've created this tool. But, for instance, we sell our technology for existing dwellings. In other words, we would put the technology in somebody's home, and that could extend their independence there for another 2 years maybe. So we're in that piece of families participating. And none of our stuff has mandatory subscription services. And we had to pay thousands of dollars to develop our own software so that it wasn't tied to these what you think of as monitoring services that have monthly fees, because we wanted the family making those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want that, that's fine. But if they don't want that, we feel that should be up to the family. So that is really what we're promoting.
Now, from a strictly business angle, how many of these would you like to sell a year? And if somebody is interested in this, how can they get in contact with the Med Cottage Corporation?
Our website is medcottage.com, and that any kind of inquiry would come through there. And we have a goal that in the first year that we would sell between 200 and 300. And we feel like that's all we as a company could probably support at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But as we do a national rollout, we've had one story on CBS. And from that one story, we probably had 4,000 inquiries.
So wow, that's quite a lot.
We know there is a market. It's just as a company, we're not mature enough yet to do the entire country, but we will be probably within the next 2 years.
And if somebody had an inquiry, they could go to your website, medcottage.com.
Yep.
Now,
yep.
It's been fascinating talking to you. What comes to me is you are not just speaking about caring for the aged, an aged family member. You're talking about whole families coming together, a change in a whole environment.
Yeah,
getting
definitely.
Generations
definitely.
Together, working together, not just caring for the elder of the family, but a whole family really making a transformation in their life as they deal with this care.
In many other parts of the world, aging is celebrated. And see, that's not a concept that's very difficult for us as Americans to sort of put our heads around, but
truly it is.
In many other countries throughout the world, it's revered. I mean, it's a stage in life where the fact that you are there, you are revered, and you celebrate the fact that you are old, and there is nothing bad about that. I'm not sure how we got here, but I would like to bring some of that here. The idea that aging is revered, and it is a respectful thing. It is a good thing, and honestly, in other countries, aged people are like heroes. It's funny to think in our culture in those terms, but that is definitely the norm in a lot of cultures.
Do you have any indication that is becoming the norm here, that people are beginning to view aging differently?
Well, I think often we are our own enemies in that process. I think our own struggle with aging is part of the problem, and that we do everything that we can to stay 40, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with being 70 if you're not trying to be 40. And that's a big problem in this culture. And if you're trying to be 40 when you're 70, you're going to be miserable. And so we are much a part of that, of our own problem. And so we make it difficult. And probably the other thing is we have probably not engaged in our family's life as a way of teaching our children how to take care of us. In other words, I'm wanting my children to watch how I take care of my parents so they will in turn take care of me in the same way. And that has to be intentional. And I feel that every day. Every day, I want my kids to look at me and see how I take care of both of my parents who are 80, how often I visit them, how much I participate in their life, and how I include them in things. Because that's the example and that's the model they're going to do with me. So I think that has to be, I think it has to be taught and it has to be intentional.
Reverend Dupin, thank you very much for being a guest on the show.
Thank you.
Appreciate
I'm honored,
it.
And I mean that. And
thank you.
Anytime. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I am Harriet Tramer, and I hope you will join me when I host Reaching for the Gold on BBS Radio. We will discuss aging and how you, as well as those you love, can navigate your way through your maturing process and even make it an adventure. The show will be broadcast on Tuesday afternoons every other week right at this time. It should be a chance to learn and also to be entertained. And I also invite you to visit my blog at justwantotalk.com, which deals with the aging issues, and from there, go on to my Facebook page. Compassion and choices has long been involved in helping people understand the options they have as regards end-of-life issues. It has worked to make people aware that they can opt for palliative care over more aggressive treatments. It focuses on pain relief instead of upon searching for a cure. Roland Hoplin serves as that organization's community group's representative. Roland, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How was your organization, Compassion and Choices, started? How was it established?
Okay. Compassion and Choices has its roots going back to 1980, and the name came about as the result of a 2005 merger between what were at the time the two largest end-of-life choice organizations, that being End-of-Life Choices and Compassion in Dying, and we simply kept the Compassion name from Compassion in Dying and the Choices name from End-of-Life Choices.
Why back in 1980? We're going to go through historical scope here. Why was this an issue? Why did this come out then? Why was it an issue then when it may not have been previously?
Part of the reason involved advances in medicine and technology, and we had reached a point where we could maintain life almost indefinitely, even in situations where the patient was unconscious with no hope of recovery.
Mm-hmm.
However, the laws hadn't caught... Go ahead.
No, go on.
I was going to say the laws hadn't caught up with the technology, and back in 1980, when the organization first began, there was only one state, that being California, that recognized what we called a Natural Death Act, and that was simply a law that allowed doctors to withhold or withdraw futile treatment if there was convincing evidence that the patient would not have wanted that type of treatment. In all other states, it would have been a crime of manslaughter for a doctor to do any intervention that would have ended a patient's life. So part of the reason for starting the organization was to try and raise awareness and pass laws in other states that would allow people to refuse unwanted and futile medical treatment. And, of course, with the passage of the Self-Determination Act in 1991, that became a reality for anybody entering a hospital. They have the right to specify in advance the types of treatment they want or don't want. Now, Compassion in Dying itself formed in 1993, and that was at the height of the AIDS epidemic. And they formed in response to concerns that patients were being abandoned, were dying in pain, or were resorting sometimes to violent means to end their suffering. And so the premise of Compassion in Dying was that no one should have to die alone, no one should have to die in pain, and no one should have to resort to violent means to end their life.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel attitudes towards these matters are now changing? In other words, are terms like palliative care, end-of-life issues, are these more part of our national dialogue? Are they discussed more openly than they ever were previously?
They are being discussed more openly, and a lot of that has to do with the success of Oregon's Death with Dignity Act that's now been in effect for 16 years. Washington's Death with Dignity Act that happened several years ago, and it looks like the governor in Vermont is ready to sign an Aid in Dying or Death with Dignity bill that was passed by the legislature just this past Monday. So I think the dialogue is improving.
Do you think that has happened just strictly because of medical advances? In other words, people say, hey, this can be done now. I don't want that done. Or do you think there's other factors that are coming into play here?
Well, I think the medical advances have a lot to do with it, and people are coming to the realization that they would prefer a quality of life over quantity. Part of this now is a lot of times in the past, doctors would simply do what the doctor thought was best and not involve the patient in the decision-making process, so patients didn't know that they had options. Nowadays, there's more information coming out, especially with advances such as the Internet and so forth, so people can explore their options and choose the one that they feel is best for them. In California, you do have a law that requires physicians to tell patients about all of their options if the patient requests it, including the option of no treatment at all.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me, you say people need to know about their options, or more people are making themselves aware of their options. Could you tell me what some of these options are?
There's options such as palliative care, which is a treatment that's given to relieve pain and symptoms. There's the option of just adequate pain management. There's also the option some people do voluntary stopping of eating and drinking as a means of ending their suffering. But spiritual counseling is appropriate for some. It really depends on what the individual's needs are. Sometimes just knowing that people have options is enough to soothe their anxiety, if you will. We deal with a lot of people who come to us who are initially very afraid because they don't know what options they have. And they think there's only one option available, and then when we're able to talk about these other options, we find most of them are willing to at least try another option to relieve their suffering.
Okay, now when you say options and relieve their suffering, I would like to get some clarification. If somebody has diagnosis of Alzheimer's and they say, oh, wow, it's all down here from this point, I don't want to suffer. I want to take my option. Would that be a case where your organization might come in, or where a doctor might discuss these options? Or is that simply a condition like any other that develops as it develops and you see what happens? I think that that's not real clear in a lot of people's minds, including mine.
Okay. Our organization primarily focuses on competent terminally ill adults, and although there's no agreement as to what terminal illness is, in states like Oregon and Washington, it's a probable life expectancy of 6 months or less.
Mm-hmm.
And under those laws, an individual has to have decision-making capacity. So we typically would not deal with an Alzheimer's patient because of the question of having the capacity, and also because even though there's some argument that Alzheimer's is a terminal illness, people can have that disease and live for 10 or 20 years.
Mm-hmm. But where these things get very tricky, and possibly you don't have an answer because nobody does, Alzheimer's is being diagnosed, from what I understand, earlier and earlier. You may not have any real, real obvious symptoms, and it may be diagnosed that you, in fact, have probable Alzheimer's. This person, might they be considered competent to make a decision and you would work with them, or is that not something your organization deals with or becomes involved in?
Well, our organization wouldn't work with them directly because, again, it doesn't involve a terminal illness.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do have is we have a form called a dementia provision that people can complete while they're still lucid, and it basically says that if they ever get to that point, here is the type of treatment I would want or not want. And so if they refuse certain treatments, it could prevent them from being kept alive against their wishes, you know, for 10 or 20 years when they were totally unaware of their surroundings. For example, an individual could say, if I develop an infection, I don't want antibiotics to combat that infection. So if someone were to get pneumonia, for instance, and didn't want antibiotics, then the pneumonia would help to end their life. Somebody could say, if I could no longer swallow, I don't want a feeding tube inserted into me. And again, that process would allow the person to end their life.
Now, to make sure this is clear, this is a dementia provision in a living will. I'm not totally understanding what you said.
Yes, it's a provision that somebody would fill out and attach to their advanced health care directive. And those are the documents that include both a living will and a durable power of attorney for health care. So it's just a form that's attached to that, and that is available as a free download from our website. So anybody who's interested in that form can just download it.
And your website is?
It would be www.compassionandandchoices.org.
In other words, you can have a provision whereby if you develop Alzheimer's, you are no longer competent to make a decision. You in this provision say, if I develop pneumonia or situation like that, do not treat. I
that
understand.
That would be correct, yes.
Okay. Now, what you tell me is fascinating, but there's certain things that just come across as blaring. What you're talking about, nobody is disagreeing, but don't they run contrary to any medical training doctors have, or at least to some medical training doctors have, which indicates you treat, you treat, you treat? Or is
that... Well, unfortunately, right, unfortunately, I think medical schools in some instances are still saying that death is a failure and you should treat, treat, and treat. But the United States Supreme Court has long recognized an individual's right to refuse unwanted medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Jehovah's Witnesses are known for refusing blood transfusions. Christian Scientists refuse most forms of medical treatment. And so any individual can say, I don't want this type of treatment. So at the end of life, or even let's go back to the Alzheimer's example, you develop an infection. If you said, I don't want the antibiotics, there is no law that can compel anybody to administer that form of treatment against your wishes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, are more and more people contacting your organization or lawyers to obtain these documents you're discussing? Is this happening more frequently?
It's happening quite frequently, and a lot of that is just because of the issue's high visibility. Vermont has been in the headlines for the past couple of months with their proposed death with dignity law. So people are raising awareness of that. They're finding us on the internet and they're requesting the forms, or they have questions about the forms, and we help them to understand what each of the forms means.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you happen to get involved in these issues yourself? Was it
well, I was drawn to the organization the way a lot of people are, through a personal experience. In my
mm-hmm.
case, it was my father,
mm-hmm.
Who died exactly how he didn't want to die, which was in a hospital with tubes and wires.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt sort of helpless as to anything I could do, and I didn't want anybody else to have to go through that experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of what attracted me to the organization initially.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you notice a generational change? In other words, are more young people, are people signing these documents at a younger and younger age?
Well, unfortunately, they're not. We'd like to see some improvement in that. And when I go out and do workshops, I point out to people that some of the very famous cases, Karen Ann Quinlan, Nancy Cruzan, and even Terry Schiavo, were all cases involving young women in their 20s who had not completed documents. And in every case, they were kept alive for a period of time between 7 and 10 years while the court tried to decide whether or not they should be taken off of life support. So we're
mm-hmm.
trying to encourage younger people to complete these documents. But when you're a younger person, you think death is 40, 50, 60 years away, and it doesn't occur to you that you could be walking down the street and get hit by a car, or you could come down with a sudden illness that would incapacitate you. So
mm-hmm.
we have a lot of work to do in that regard. But it is, that being said, it is improving, because a lot of younger people now are helping their parents complete those documents and discussing what their parents want. So it's raising awareness for them.
Well, I think these things may be blossoming, because many millions, literally millions, of people have had an experience like you discussed with your father. Many baby boomers particularly have had these experiences, and they may then discuss these things amongst themselves and then with their children. So I do think it may be spreading between generations.
We would certainly hope so.
Tell us a little bit about your workshops, how that happens. If I came to one of these workshops, what would I learn?
What we would do is we would talk about the history that that brought us to the point where people do have decision-making capacity. And as I mentioned back in 1980, only California had a Natural Death Act. But we talk a little bit about the history. We talk specifically about the state that they're in, because different states have different provisions for the advance directives. And then we go over what these terms mean. You know, what does extraordinary treatment mean? Because what
does
it mean? Considered, well, we don't know, and that's one of the problems that we talk about. We say that 5 or 10 years ago, such as pacemakers or things like that, are considered routine today, so that we have to be very careful if we just say, I don't want heroic or extraordinary measures. You know, what does that mean? What does heroic mean? So we talk
about
putting the language.
What's heroic now?
About,
go ahead.
No, so what we do is we talk about use other language. Don't use these terms that are subject to interpretation. For example, if I'm in pain, you know, what does that mean? Try and specify it some other way. You know, even if it's putting a scale on a scale of 1 to 10, if I seem to be at 8 or 9, that sort of thing. So it's just raising awareness that you have to be pretty clear, and we are very insistent that people discuss their wishes. Some people complete these documents and they file them away in a drawer, and they've never had the conversation. And then the adult child might get a hold of the document and say, well, I'm not really sure what my parent meant by this. So we encourage the conversation, not only with the decision maker who might be the spouse, an adult child, but also to have that conversation with the individual's physician, so the physician knows what he or she might want or not want.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you find that your organization has encountered much resistance by people who may not understand this and may think you are doing some unacceptable things?
Well, there is religious opposition. Because a lot of people believe that only God knows the time and manner of your death, and that you shouldn't be hastening your death. And we certainly understand and respect those beliefs, but we would also ask those that follow those beliefs to be respectful of people who may believe differently and may not think what they're doing is a sin. But we do have some opposition from religious groups from time to time. I think that's declining, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that nowadays, more people are opting for palliative care. They are opting for spiritual counseling and other forms of treatment. And when we look at Oregon, that's had a law now for 16 years, on average, only 50 people are using that law a year. It's a very small number compared with about 31,000 people that die every year in Oregon of all causes. So a very small number of people actually use the law. We find that about 9 out of 10 people that come to us will select some other option once their options have been explained to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Could you give an example? You say select some other options. Could you give an example of how that might work?
Well, palliative care, for instance. Somebody might not understand or know what palliative care is, so we can explain to them, do you realize that there are medications that a doctor can give you to relieve the pain and relieve the symptoms? Are you aware that if you enroll in hospice, they can take care of your needs and they can give your caregiver respite and they can attend to the daily functions and so forth? So a lot of those things relieve anxiety and fear about the dying process. And a lot of people who enter hospice will say, okay, I'm going to try it. And then when they get in, they find that their needs are being met, and they, at that point, want to go on and live as full a life as they have left rather than hasten their death.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say that terminal illness is often defined by a doctor saying this person has life expectancy of 6 months or less. There's some indication that doctors often misjudge that. In other words, they say 6 months and it's much less, or they may think this person has more than 6 months and that just isn't the way things work. How does that factor into this?
Well, you know, these studies are interesting because it shows, the several published studies have shown that the longer the doctor-patient relationship, the longer the doctor is likely to give the individual. So in other words, if they've had a relationship for a long time, the doctor is going to err on the side of living a lot longer rather than living less.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it doesn't matter what the consultation is, because as you mentioned, it's not an exact science. We know from the Oregon and Washington experience that very few people actually get the medication and take it the same day. And in a lot of instances, they'll want that medication, they'll put it in the medicine cabinet and say, it's there if I need it. And in fact, a third of the patients in Oregon who get medication never take it.
A third never do?
A third never do. So for them, it's just an insurance, if you will, that if all else fails, I have this option. But we know from the Oregon, we know from the reports that come out of Oregon, because they do record all this information, that some of the patients who have been diagnosed as terminal waited 2 years, or in some instances, almost 3 years before taking the medication. So as long as the quality of life is there, we find that everybody wants to live. It's only when the pain and symptoms can no longer be managed that they consider those options.
Mm-hmm. I must say, what you're telling me is fascinating, because what I see is not only, you're talking about a whole social change in the way we look at medicine, social change in the way we look not only at end of life, but truly in the way we look at life. It's a big leap, what you're talking about. It really is.
Well, it's a big leap, but really I think we're kind of getting back to the roots. And if we go back, you know, 100 years ago, when somebody got sick, they either got better or they didn't. You know, when somebody was dying, it was a situation where the family and even the community would be with that person. And after they died, they'd be in the parlor. That's where the funeral parlor got its name from, where people could come and say their goodbyes, and then everybody might accompany the person to the cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
But with the introduction of IVs and antibiotics and ambulances, what happens now is when somebody gets ill, they might get whisked away to a hospital that's miles away from where they lived, and friends and family can't visit them, or if they can, it's during certain hours. And so we've taken death from being something that was very much in our minds and awareness, and made it something that was really afraid, a scary thing, because people would go away and die, and we wouldn't mm-hmm. know exactly how they died at the end.
Thank you. I think
by having these discussions, we're getting back to that point where we can talk about it and accept it, because we are all going to die. And if we prepare for it and have the discussion, we're going to have a better death than if we're trying to fight it tooth and nail all the way to the end.
Thank you very much for being a guest. I appreciate it.
You're very, very welcome. And again, people can find more information on our website, www.compassionandchoices.org. And we have free forms for download, the dementia provision I mentioned, as well as advanced healthcare directives and other useful forms.
Thank you.
Okay, have a great day.